Hey, future doctors, welcome back to Spoonful of Sugar. We have an amazing episode in store for you today on a much-needed topic. Let's let the hosts introduce themselves and take it away.
Hey, future doctors, thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Tal Sherman, and I'm a medical student at Drexel University College of Medicine, and I will be your host today. So today we will be diving into a high-yield topic of vaginitis or vulvovaginitis. This is one of the most common gynecologic conditions, accounting for millions of visits annually. It's not just a high-yield topic for exams, but also for clinical practice because its presentation can overlap, making diagnosis and management challenging. Today we're going to cover the most common causes of vaginitis, which are bacterial vaginosis, or BV, candidiasis, and trichomoniasis. We'll also touch briefly on non-infectious causes of vulvovaginitis, which are especially relevant in children, and discuss considerations for managing infectious vulvovaginitis during pregnancy. Throughout the episode, I'm going to ask questions to help test your knowledge, so feel free to pause, think about the answers, and play along. Remember, this is a review to solidify what you know, so don't be discouraged if some details are new or need refreshing. So first, let's set the stage. Vulvovaginitis encompasses a range of conditions that cause inflammation of the vulva and vagina. It can have either infectious causes, such as bacterial vaginosis, or non-infectious origins. Normally, the vaginal flora, primarily composed of lactobacilli, maintains a low pH in vaginal fluids, which helps prevent the overgrowth of harmful organisms. When this balance is disrupted, for example, during sexual intercourse, it increases the risk of infection and inflammation. The most common infectious causes are bacterial vaginosis, candidiasis, and trichomoniasis. These conditions differ in their pathophysiology, clinical presentation, and treatment. Infectious vulvovaginitis is diagnosed by examining vaginal discharge under a microscope, and treatment typically involves antibiotics or antifungal medications depending on the identified pathogen. But remember, vaginitis can also have the non-infectious causes, like irritants, allergens, or poor hygiene, particularly in pediatric populations. So let's start with a quick question about the overview. What are the three most common causes of vaginitis? So the three most common causes are bacterial vaginosis, or BV, Candida vulvovaginitis, and trichomoniasis. And each has a distinct presentation and management approach, so we will go over that now. So what is the most common vaginal infection? This is going to be bacterial vaginosis. And what is the pathogen for bacterial vaginosis? It's Gardnerella vaginalis, which is a pleomorphic gram-variable rod. And what is the pathophysiology for BV? So lower concentrations of lactobacillus lead to overgrowth of Gardnerella vaginalis and other anaerobes. What are some risk factors for BV? So sexual intercourse is the primary risk factor, but BV is still not considered an STI. Other risk factors are IUDs, vaginal douching, and pregnancy. What are the clinical features or symptoms of BV? So it's commonly asymptomatic, but increased vaginal discharge can be a symptom, and it's usually gray or milky with a fishy odor. It is also uncommon to have pruritus or pain. How do we diagnose BV? So diagnosis is confirmed if three of the following AMSEL criteria are met, and that's AMSEL, AMSEL criteria. So number one is the presence of Klue cells, which are vaginal epithelial cells that have fuzzy borders due to bacteria adhering to the cell surface, and they're identified on a vaginal wet mount prep. The second is vaginal pH greater than 4.5. The third is positive amine test, sometimes referred to as a whiff test. And the fourth is thin homogeneous gray-white or yellow discharge that adheres to the vaginal walls. So how do we treat BV? So if the patient is asymptomatic, you can reassure them because it often resolves without treatment. However, if the patient is symptomatic, first-line treatment is oral metronidazole, or you could use intravaginal metronidazole or intravaginal clindamycin. Some complications are adverse pregnancy outcomes like preterm delivery, spontaneous abortion, or postpartum endometritis. Reinfection can also occur, so you can consider retesting after 3 months. So moving on, what is the second most common cause of vulvovaginitis, which is going to account for about 20 to 40% of all cases? This is going to be vulvovaginal candidiasis, with the primary pathogen of Candida albicans. In immunosuppressed patients, you'll also see Candida glabrata, G-L-A-B-R-A-T-A. The pathophysiology is similar to BV. You're going to see an overgrowth of C. albicans. What are some of the risk factors for candidiasis? Pregnancy is one, also immunodeficiency, both systemic and local immunodeficiencies, and also antimicrobial treatment, like after receiving systemic antibiotic treatment. What is the classic presentation for vulvovaginal candidiasis? So typically you're going to see white, crumbly, and sticky vaginal discharge that may appear like cottage cheese and is typically odorless. The vulva and vagina are going to be erythematous, and they might experience vaginal burning sensations, severe pruritus, dysuria, or dyspareunia. So how is vulvovaginal candidiasis diagnosed? Typically, you're going to see pseudohyphae or budding yeast or hyphae on a vaginal wet mount with potassium hydroxide or KOH. And is the vaginal pH going to be within normal range or above normal range for vulvovaginal candidiasis? So the pH for vulvovaginal candidiasis is going to be within normal range, which is 4 to 4.5. This is the only one that you're going to see typically below 4.5 because both BV and trichomoniasis are usually at a pH of above 4.5. So moving on to treatment, what is the first line treatment for vulvovaginal candidiasis? Typically in uncomplicated non-pregnant individuals, topical azoles like clotrimazole or miconazole are given, or a single dose of oral fluconazole. However, for pregnant individuals, topical azoles are generally recommended like clotrimazole and miconazole, but oral fluconazole is not recommended for use in pregnant patients because of a possible association with fetal malformations or spontaneous abortions. Moving on to trichomoniasis, this is going to account for about 4 to 35% of all cases of vulvovaginitis. So what is the pathogen? The pathogen is Trichomonas vaginalis. It's an anaerobic, motile protozoan with flagella. How is trichomoniasis transmitted? It is sexually transmitted and is often asymptomatic in men. What are the key clinical features of trichomoniasis? So typically you're going to see foul-smelling, frothy, yellowish-greenish, purulent discharge. The patient might describe experiencing vulvovaginal pruritus, a burning sensation, dysuria, and a quote-unquote strawberry cervix, which is caused by punctate hemorrhages on the cervical epithelium. It's also described as an erythematous mucosa with petechiae on speculum exam. So how is it diagnosed? The initial test is a saline vaginal wet mount. And if it's positive, you'll see motile trophozoites with multiple flagella. If the wet mount is inconclusive, you can perform a culture or an NAAT, which is a nucleic acid amplification test. Additionally, trichomoniasis is going to have a pH with a vaginal discharge of greater than 4.5. And routine screening in asymptomatic patients is generally not recommended. So what is the treatment for trichomoniasis? First-line treatment is going to be oral metronidazole, and it is crucial to also treat the sexual partners to prevent reinfection. So those are the main high-yield points for infectious vulvovaginitis. Let's review some of the high yield points before we move on to non-infectious vulvovaginitis. So what are the key differences in vaginal pH among the three causes of vaginitis? The answer is BV and trichomoniasis typically have an elevated pH greater than 4.5, while candida infections usually have a normal pH of less than 4.5 and generally within the range of 4 to 4.5. So which one comes to mind if I mention fishy odor, clue cells, and thin gray discharge? That's going to be BV. What about cottage cheese discharge, itching, and pseudohyphae? That's going to be candida. And then what about frothy green discharge, strawberry cervix, and motile trichomonads? That's going to be trichomoniasis. What are the first line treatments for BV and trichomoniasis, and which one do you also have to treat the sexual partners? So first line treatment is going to be metronidazole for both, and trichomoniasis is the one where you have to treat the sexual partners to prevent reinfection. So moving on to the non-infectious vulvovaginitis. These are a little less commonly tested, but still important nonetheless. The main differentials on this list are going to be genitourinary syndrome of menopause, allergic vulvovaginitis, and mechanical vulvovaginitis. Although genitourinary syndrome of menopause is not technically a vulvovaginitis, it can have overlapping symptoms like dyspareunia, urinary symptoms, vaginal soreness, dryness, so it's sometimes tested alongside the other causes of vulvovaginitis. Allergic vulvovaginitis is a contact allergy. What age group is typically associated with allergic vulvovaginitis? While it can affect all age groups, it is especially common in prepubescent girls. The etiologies are allergies, so it's usually laundry detergents or cleaning detergents, specific fibers or fabrics, or sanitary napkins that come into contact with the skin. What are some of the clinical features or manifestations? It's going to be signs of inflammation, pruritus, burning sensation, maybe some redness and swelling of the skin. And how is it diagnosed? So specific allergy diagnostics may be indicated if the symptoms persist despite treatment. And what is that treatment? So the treatment's going to be avoiding irritants, applying some moisturizers and cooling, maybe some cortisone creams. Next is mechanical vulvovaginitis. So the etiology is going to be pruritus, usually due to atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, or some psychosomatic conditions. It can also be due to friction of tight clothes and obesity. And individuals suffering from postmenopausal estrogen deficiency or lichen sclerosis are especially at high risk for mechanical vulvovaginitis. The clinical features are similar, being pruritus, redness, swelling, sometimes dysuria, and or dyspareunia. How do you diagnose mechanical vulvovaginitis? So diagnosis is made with special dermatological or rheumatological tests to find the cause of the pruritus. And treatment alongside depends on the cause. You can use soothing lotions or creams, ice packs, and sitz baths containing chamomile. Lastly, I want to discuss vulvovaginitis in pediatric populations. So it's the most common gynecologic disorder in prepubertal children. What do you think some of the etiologies are? So the first and most common cause is poor hygiene, and then foreign body in the genitourinary tract. Other etiologies are use of perfumed soaps and bubble baths, localized skin disorders, and in some cases, sexual abuse. What is the pathophysiology of vulvovaginitis in children? So estrogen levels are typically lower in prepubescent individuals, making the vulvar skin and vaginal mucosa very thin, and this thinness makes it more susceptible to vulvovaginitis of any cause. What are some of the clinical features of vulvovaginitis in children? Vaginal discharge, it can often be bloody, purulent, or foul-smelling. Pain in the lower abdomen and suprapubic region is also common. Additionally, increased urinary frequency, burning during urination, and dysuria. And in some cases, a visible segment of a foreign body at the genital opening, if the etiology is a foreign body in the genitourinary tract. So, how do you diagnose vulvovaginitis in children? If it is an infectious etiology, and that is suspected, then you can do appropriate testing, whether that be a Gram stain, DNA PCR, a culture, a KOH prep. If another etiology is suspected, like foreign body in the genitourinary tract, then direct visualization of the foreign body, either on physical exam or by means of a pelvic ultrasound or plain pelvic radiography, vaginography, or MRI can be used. So, how do you treat vulvovaginitis in children? In the case of a foreign body, removal of the foreign body is first-line treatment. You do warm saline irrigation of the vagina in an outpatient setting, and if that irrigation fails, you can remove under general anesthesia. Antibiotics and antifungals generally aren't needed if the foreign body is removed successfully, as the vulvovaginitis would spontaneously resolve after removal. If it is another etiology, topical or oral antibiotics or antifungals can be used depending on the source, and conservative measures like improving hygiene, avoiding tight clothing, weight loss can be used in this patient population. For the last note on infectious vulvovaginitis in pregnancy, it's important to understand that during pregnancy, infectious vulvovaginitis requires special attention. Bacterial vaginosis and trichomoniasis are associated with adverse outcomes like preterm labor and low birth weight, so treating symptomatic cases is critical. For candidiasis, oral fluconazole is contraindicated and generally avoided, and topical antifungals like clotrimazole are preferred for safety. So to recap, we discussed the three main causes of vaginitis: bacterial vaginosis, candidiasis, and trichomoniasis, and reviewed their clinical features, diagnosis, and treatment. We also touched on non-infectious vulvovaginitis in children and infectious vulvovaginitis in pregnancy. So remember, bacterial vaginosis is thin gray discharge, Klue cells, pH greater than 4.5, and treated with metronidazole. Candida is a cottage cheese discharge. It's associated with itching. It has a normal pH and is treated with fluconazole. Trichomoniasis is associated with a frothy green discharge, has a strawberry cervix on speculum exam, and is treated with metronidazole, additionally with the sexual partners of the patient. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope this review was helpful. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to Spoonful of Sugar. If you have any questions, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember, if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.